Have you seen these implants? Six small white rubber thingies about the size of toothpicks, which work like time capsules and which are inserted into a woman's upper arm, much the same way you'd put carrots in a pita pocket? And which brings up for the millionth time, why in heaven's name are contraceptive contraptions always being invented for women and not men? I mean, you know what my rule of thumb for the relative comfort and advisability of contraceptives for women is, whether or not I'd use it. And just between you and me and the fence post, ladies, a good half of the stuff you end up dealing with, I couldn't handle on a bet. Of course, men are such cowards, really, compared to women. And by that, I mean, sure, they'll charge up San Juan Hill with 1,000 other guys. But get a booster shot or a root canal? Forget it. And whoever said if men had to have babies, there wouldn't be 10 births a year is probably overestimating output by at least 5. And now what shows up in the long line of greatest hits for women only, but little inner tubes that leak. On the plus side, we are told Norplant can either be inserted or removed with minor surgery in a few minutes. It's relatively cheap, either uses little or none of the contraceptive chemicals that are suspected of being health hazards. On average, lasts 5 years with a higher percentage of protection than most other products. On the negative side, Norplant is not recommended for women who smoke and can cause irregular menstrual periods, headaches, weight changes, skin rashes, and nervousness in 20 to 25% of those who try it, though again, it's easy to remove. Now, I would continue this commentary, but my knowledge of this topic is understandably limited. You see, I was raised a Catholic. And when that happens, the only thing you learn about birth control is that it requires something called rhythm. And for the first 20 years of your life, the only thing you're ever told about rhythm is that if you have it, you must get married. And if you don't, you can't dance.
The voice you just heard was Wayne Shannon. And this was one of many witty and frequently iconoclastic commentaries that he produced over several decades as a television commentator. Years before Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert entertained audiences with their quick barbs and witty retorts, Shannon was there first, going after shady auto sellers, spoofing Rocky without apology, and tackling the problems of our time with a brio that today's VHF stations wouldn't consider commercial. But who knows Wayne Shannon today? I asked this question in September 2006 on my blog when some synaptic connection kicked in, a really odd memory process, and I realized that not a single person on the internet had bothered to remember who Wayne Shannon was. They hadn't logged him, they hadn't set up a web page for him, and I turned out to be the first. Now, I had fond memories of Wayne Shannon from his commentaries, which I had remembered growing up watching Channel 4, which is KRON, in the South Bay. That's in the Bay Area in California. But what I hadn't anticipated was such an outcry from other people on the internet wanting to know exactly what happened to this guy. And I certainly didn't expect Wayne Shannon himself to leave a comment, and he did, and he informed a lot of people of what he was up to and the like. And then Wayne Shannon and I started emailing each other, and he was really gracious. He also sent me a personalized DVD of some of his work, and what I didn't count on was how wonderful these clips were, how much better these were compared against my memory, and even compared to what we have to deal with today on the tube. And I felt compelled to give Mr. Shannon, a winner of 10 Emmys, a spot on this podcast, because the world really needs to know about him. What I didn't anticipate was that this would be one of the most difficult interviews I've ever conducted, which is why you're getting me, Ed Champion, and not Bat Segundo. Now, I should first point out that I was very nervous, more nervous than I had been with other authors, some of them quite major. This was probably because I really wanted to give Shannon his proper due. Now, because of this, I forgot to record the first few minutes of our conversation, but I didn't anticipate how the nature of Shannon's creative output tied in with his personal life. Wayne Shannon's story is painful, and it took me a long time to get around to finishing this podcast, but you really need to hear this guy's story. Very rarely does an opportunity to give some obscure figure a limelight come along, and very rarely does it turn out like this.
To the floor. They had one camera that roved, but they had three or four cameras, and they were nailed to the floor. And so they could zoom and pan. But I was about, I would probably say, at least 30 feet away from the camera that you saw when I was at CNBC. Then I had much better eyesight than I have now. Yeah. I don't think I could read a teleprompter from that far anymore.
Yeah, yeah, gotcha. Well, I also wanted to ask you about this image of you as a consumer reporter. You, as you pointed out earlier, a troubleshooter. Why did they decide upon you being sort of a consumer reporter? Was this really the only way that they could actually put you into the newsroom legitimately, to as the so-called token nut, as you sort of suggested, or?
That kind of happened in an odd way. I ended up going across the street from Cairo TV in Seattle to Como TV in Seattle when that fellow Jim Harriet moved from Cairo to Como. I came with him. And the main female anchor at the time, her husband was an agent, an on-air talent agent for TV. And he came to me and introduced himself one day, and I was just a bottom writer. Well, I wasn't a bottom writer, but I was a writer at Como TV, an ABC affiliate there, and he came in and introduced himself to me as the husband of, and said, you know, you're funnier than a crutch. I've got a TV station out in Detroit that's looking for an unusual character to play the part of a troubleshooter. He has to be, you know, someone that's just not a straight news reporter, and he had seen all of my stuff in Seattle, and he knew me from other people. And so he set up the interview in Detroit, and I went out there. That Detroit gig was my first ever full-time job as a reporter.
Gotcha. Now, in terms of the name R. Wayne Shannon, the sort of proprietary nature that you had in the stations that you worked for, how did that come about? It's very, very, you know, like R. Wayne Shannon, not your Wayne Shannon.
Actually, I don't know. I can tell you this much. There are no compete clauses in on-air contracts. When they say our Edward Champion, they mean our. We own him.
Yeah.
And if he decides to leave next year, he's not going on the air at another station across town. On another radio station, or at a competing magazine or newspaper.
Yeah,
in this market.
Yeah, well, that's true. But they never said that. Say R. Jim Paymar. I mean, they never said R. Tom Snyder or R. Maury Povich. You know what I mean?
Well, I wrote most of the intros, and I didn't do that on purpose. But I think probably during the days when I was writing basic copy, that was the habit of introing, say, a feature reporter or a weathercaster, you know, something like that. It wasn't something that you said from one anchor to, you know, that we would have one anchor say to another.
Yeah.
But I think it just came about because of the years when I started out as just a writer that would write lead-ins and tags, you know, for various and sundry things.
Gotcha. Now, I also wanted to ask you about, since these commentaries were very heavily scripted, and since the cue sheets that you did for the editing were heavily scripted, did you go off book for a lot of these things? I mean, when they threw you in the field, or they threw you in with another reporter, such as in the clip on CNBC when you're with that rather serious-looking gentleman who you were co-anchoring with, and he's sort of not understanding exactly entirely what's going on, or at least playing that way. Did you sort of need to have this really heavy script for everything you did, or was there some improvisational ability that you needed to do on a regular basis as well?
Well, those two shows, Your Working Life and The Real Estate Report, were shows that, and this has all happened in the first two or three years of CNBC, you know, which has just changed entirely, and all of the on-air talent that was there when I was there, I think, are almost entirely gone now. So it was a much more bare-bones operation. I never had the impression that NBC was absolutely positive that this network was going to survive.
Yeah.
So they had a tendency to play it pretty close to the vest. And, for instance, I wrote the lead-ins and tags and the news stories that were in all of those shows. Whenever a guest was on, we'd write a little introduction, you know, this is what we're going to be seeing next, so-and-so from such and such. And it was mostly ad-libbed after that.
Were there any advantages to ad-libbing over heavy scripting? Or, I mean, I guess that's sort of my question. Do you feel that you just really needed to have a script to work with as a guide, that you needed that in order to actually go ahead and maintain this Wayne Shannon persona, this Wayne Shannon presence on television?
No, I just pretty much did what I was told to do. As the commentary thing became more popular and I got better known, at least in the industry, they wanted more and more commentaries out of me. I used to do two live on the, I guess, 6 and 11 o'clock news at, like, say, Channel 4 in San Francisco, and then I would record, I would write two more on Friday, record those, and they would run on Saturday and Sunday on the 11 o'clock news. Well, they knew about that when I got hired at CNBC. I had to do nine commentaries a day, three in rotation, and then write two more. So I wrote three a day, Monday through Friday, and then five on Friday, so that they could run those on one of the programs, or two programs that ran on the weekends on CNBC. So I was on the air 7 days a week in both places, at KRON and at CNBC. And then, I even got to the point where I worked for a year and a half, 7 days a week, because I had acquired a different agent by the time I got to CNBC. And he got me a year and a half gig on NBC Radio, which at the time wasn't owned by NBC Radio. I think it was Westwood One or something. Mm-hmm. So I would come in on Sundays and write 5 one-minute commentaries for NBC Radio, and then would record this, send them by phone. We'd record them much like you're doing right now. And they would air them at different times all over the country.
Wow.
I was really, really cranking out commentaries when the phosphates hit the air projection unit.
Well, that surely you're going to get burned out after a while. Did you take any kind of breaks in that year and a half, or did you just constantly pump them out? I mean, what did you do to constantly generate ideas like this?
I was well into my second horrific marriage by then, and I adored my children. I was one of those fathers that would actually take them out shopping, you know, so they could say, "Daddy, I want this, I want that, I want this," because I could do okay as long as I was with the kids. But I was having a very difficult time staying at home with my soon-to-be ex-wife. So I pretty much did it because there was nowhere else to go.
Well, I mean, talking about sequential commentaries, or I actually want to go back to your early days where you did these, what's almost unthinkable today, where you have a 5-part narrative or a 10-part story on lemons or whatnot. I was wondering, you know, I mean, that you can't really do that kind of thing today, and yet they also had these really elaborate title sequences, which I presume were carried over the course of the weekdays. I mean, was this part of the nature of doing the, you know, being the troubleshooter, of having a sort of consistent narrative like this?
No, it had more to do with their basic trust in me. Those segments, that 10-part series on Lemons of Detroit, those ran from 6 to 8 minutes in length.
Yeah.
The Academy music, the musical Academy leader that I had up front. I mean, it just went on and on and on. The problem is that I was successful. In other words, the reason I sent you the third episode, which is the only one I've ever kept,
yeah,
of the 1980 Rock series, was because by that night, our station went from number 3 and a distant number 3 to a clean, clear number 1 in the market, and it remained that way for at least as long as I was at WJBK, as far as I know. I'm told that's what happened. Hmm. I wasn't purview to the, you know, the rating results or anything in those days, or privy to them, I should say.
Yeah.
But I'm told that, you know, so they were taking a huge chance because I was taking on the Big Four, and but I did it in such a way that there was no arguing about it. You know, it was kind of I'm guessing that the bottom line was, you know, as crazy as this guy is, if we let him go, it pays off.
Yeah.
And that reputation followed me the whole way. So yeah, I don't think you're going to find any news directors that will allow anybody to do one 8-minute segment for 10 nights, Monday through Friday, 2 weeks in a row.
No, I don't think so either. I mean, this also sort of raises a very interesting question about kind of agitating some of the higher-ups while simultaneously turning their news into the number one station. Is this why you think you were allowed to survive for so long? But you also bounced around quite a lot, but I'm wondering, what was this relationship like? I mean, under what circumstances did people sort of say, oh, well, maybe, Wayne, you're going a little too far? I mean, did you have to constantly sort of fight against sort of dictums that were laid down that said that you were taking things too extreme?
Well, you know, there were times when I got death threats. I knew somehow, you know, I told you, I don't think I told you, but I certainly implied that I grew up thoroughly and completely believing, no question, that I was short, fat, dumb, and ugly, and that's the way way I grew up, and that's how I went into my life, my adult life. So I didn't expect to succeed. I didn't expect to be able to make a living. I thought maybe, you know, if I'm a reporter, I won't be one for long, and if I'm lucky, I'll end up being a writer. But somehow I knew, after the success started, that it was my turn at the watch. I knew who I was working for the whole time. And I was working for the American public. And as corny as it sounds, I believed it was my turn at the watch and that I should do the right thing and that I should take whatever other people thought was my talent, which was humor. I had no belief in me whatsoever and still don't, either as a human or as an on-air talent or a writer or whatever. But I sensed that this was early on, because that first full-time reporting job was me trying to find a way to help people with the second largest investment they ever make in their lifetime. Other than a house, it's usually a car.
Yeah.
And as I see the ads now, you know, for 10-year, 100,000-mile warranties, you know, being bandied about left and right, there's a little part of me that says, you know, I played a role in that.
Yeah.
I know I did. And I continued then because the people kept offering me jobs, and I just took them and was always surprised.
Well, I mean, I would also argue that in many ways, you were ahead of The Daily Show and Stephen Colbert. I mean, in fact, I should point out to you that in one of the segments that you sent me, you refer to the audience as sports fans. And this is interesting to me because I'm not sure if you're familiar with Zay Frank, who is this web commentator who did a lot of short commentaries for, like, you know, 2 to 5 minutes, perhaps, like, you know, the latest incarnation of this type of commentator. But he addresses his audience as sports racers. So I'm wondering, you know, in terms of, I mean, do you if you think so little of yourself, I would argue that there was some kind of innovation that was possibly laid down, whether consciously or subconsciously, to another generation of commentators along these lines. And in fact, I mean, you know, I'm shocked that none of these are available, like, on YouTube or something.
I have been told, I've never seen the film, and I don't know why, but that movie that came out of Detroit about automobiles, and, you know, it was called Me and Henry or something like
Roger
that.
Roger and Me, you mean?
Say again?
Roger and Me?
Yes, Roger and Me. That some of the conceptual presentation elements of the 1980 Rock series are in that film. And that guy might well have been in Detroit when I was taking on the Big Four. I don't know. I've never seen the movie, and I don't know why, because I guess, well, I'm relatively busy these days.
Yeah.
Not with anything that has to do with the biz, but I just haven't gotten around to seeing Roger and Me, because my darling Dr. Cheryl, my significant other, her son has seen the movie, and he saw the entire series. I used to have it on a huge set of, you know, 10 VHSs. And he's seen the whole series, and he swears that guy must have seen some of that stuff that I did in 1980 Rocks and incorporated it in Roger and Me.
Michael Moore.
And, if so, I would be terribly flattered.
Wow. But this is Michael Moore, and he's made millions of dollars making these leftist documentaries as well. I mean, if that is the case, that's quite an astonishing sort of thing. It almost demands that you put these things onto YouTube so people can decide for themselves.
Possibly. But, you know, over the years, my lines kept popping up at different places, and by that I mean punchlines.
Yeah.
Robin Williams was on one of those things to raise money for the poor, and he used one of my lines. Women, you can't live with them, and you can't live with them. And then I used to have a line when somebody would give me a compliment, I would say, as General George S. Patton used to say, tanks. And that showed up in one of George Lucas's films. In which I think it was the third one, in which this guy is talking to a foreign potentate, and he said, "We wanted to thank you for all our gifts, the this, the that, and the tanks." And the guy says, "You're welcome."
Wow.
So I know where that line came from, because George Lucas was right there in the Bay Area. So, you know, or Skywalker Ranch or whatever it is out there in Marin County.
Yeah.
So I always kind of sensed that I was being heard, and that I was, you know, somebody was looking that would, had the access to the American public as well, but I was nothing more than flattered, and then it quickly went away. For some reason, positive things about me don't, well, I think they produce ulcers, because I've got at least two.
Oh, jeez. Well, what kept you sort of going? I mean, how obviously you're affecting people and you're making people laugh. I mean, what was the situation going? I mean, is it really was your kids were the things that were sort of keeping you going at this game? Is that really what it was? Or
I'll tell you what was odd was being canonized, so to speak, in public, as celebrities tend to be. I mean, you know, people come around you and they go, oh my God, and they want your autograph and all this kind of stuff. But at least the ones that approached me, I mean, I also had a lot of people who didn't like me. I took on the Klan and mispronounced their name. Skinheads, you name it, I took them on. And I got death threats because of it and so on and so forth. But anyway, the dichotomy, I guess, is what caught me, what kept me alive. At home, I was not, shall I say, well-loved. And out in the public, I was. The dichotomy just about drove me crazy.
Oh, wow.
But as long as I was out of the house and not being abused in some important way, it was very positive. And for most intents and purposes, I came to live for the job that I knew eventually would go away. And I wondered what would happen when it did. And when it did, I hit the all-time low that I suspected was coming.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, going back to these commentaries, if you were pumping them out so fast, particularly during the CNBC days, did you get a chance to practice these at all, or did you just essentially kind of deliver them almost one take?
I always subjected people in the newsroom to hearing it.
Uh-huh.
I would always say, I literally would say, Helen, have you got a minute for a chuckle?
Yeah, yeah.
And they'd sit down and I'd read it to them. I would read them. I always read out loud. I still do to this day, which drives people crazy when I'm writing a memo, but whatever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm wondering, though, also, there is one element to watching some of the Kron commentaries in decades later, and that is sort of seeing the news crew laugh at almost everything, when, in fact, comedy is really more of a narrative. It's really a sort of situation in which you have to tap into that narrative. It's not necessarily a chuckle fest. And so I'm wondering how you negotiated that kind of environment, if there were so many people who saw you as the funny guy, or even saw you as this kind of Wayne Shannon persona when there was a fundamentally different Wayne Shannon. What steps did you do to the sort of, I guess, did you manage to protect yourself from some of these influences so you can concentrate on that particular narrative, that you could just go ahead and deliver these commentaries down in a way that was just true to the message of what you had to say?
Well, let me explain it to you this way. I once saw Richard Pryor, Bill Cosby, and, oh my word, Sidney Poitier, mm-hmm. all sitting on stage together. And Bill Cosby was in the middle, and Richard Pryor was on, and Richard Pryor and Sidney Poitier were on each side of Bill. Everything that Richard Pryor said absolutely collapsed Poitier. The term you're looking for is, or that I'm looking for is, I've got your number. In other words, there are times over time, if you get into a comic, that they can damn near say anything that'll make you laugh.
Yeah.
Every gesture, everything they say, you have got their number. And over the years, eventually, I would convince the anchors that I was funny, and a lot of them didn't like me.
Yeah.
A lot of them didn't like me. I had one anchor at Kron, K-R-O-N, when I first got there, who had applied for a job as an anchor and commentator and didn't get the gig. He got the anchor part, but they wouldn't let him do commentary. So who comes on the set but this fat clown?
Yeah.
I mean, he was very, very angry with me. And, I mean, he wouldn't talk to me. He never, ever laughed, so on and so forth. Well, after he was there for about 2 years, and I was at Kron for six, one of the last commentaries I did, I used to do serious commentaries every now and then, and I did one time that actually made him tear up. I think it was when Robert Kennedy's son died or something, and I tied it all together, the son of Caesar and so on, and it made this guy tear up. And he came over to my desk. I didn't know it, but he had been told his contract wasn't going to be renewed. He only had 2 weeks left. And he said, I wanted to tell you this, but I've only got 2 weeks left here, which was news to me. And it's taken me every damn day to figure out why they hired you. And now I know.
Wow. I mean, yeah, I'll go for it.
Yeah, and that, it just knocked me out.
Wow.
But anyway, to ultimately answer your question, once you get somebody. Well, you know, like Roz Abrams. Holy mackerel, I could make that woman cry laughing. I just had her number. Every now and then a comic gets somebody's number, and they laugh, and once you got them, you got them. And they listen closely, which, of course, was the ultimate goal, as you know, of humor. You use whatever you can as a vehicle to get people to pay attention, because if they don't pay attention, it doesn't make a difference whether or not you're telling the truth or an absolute lie.
Yeah.
With American writers, I would imagine most Democratic writers, in democracies, you know, when you write, you're trying to tell them something. You're seeing something you think they ought to see or understand. And if they won't listen to you, if they see your name in print or mine, or they hear my tease on TV and they won't listen and they won't read, they won't turn the page to read your story, what have we got? We got nothing.
Yeah.
Our turn at the watch has been wasted. So you and I struggle, as do all writers, in hopefully a relatively free society, to get them to pay attention. Because for some reason, we've got something we've got to say. And most of us, thank God, know to do the right thing when the time comes. Problem is, you don't always know when the time comes, and you don't know whether or not you're really up to your turn at the watch. But if it happens, you find out pretty quick.
Well, it's
hopefully you have what the country needs.
Yeah. Well, it's not. I don't think it's necessarily about having what the country needs. I think it's more about just continual process. What people don't realize of writers and commentators, and even the greatest writers have told me this, is that really it is about turning something in and just keeping up a routine. And it sounds to me that if you just constantly remain in practice, just as someone is a plumber or a mechanic or a lawyer and who constantly does that, eventually you will get better if you have a talent for it. Is there something to be said for that? Can you attribute your 10 Emmys to essentially constantly staying in shape like this, constantly going ahead and putting out in the CNBC case, a very considerable amount of routine?
Mm-hmm. I know what you're saying. You're saying that writers do a lot of their writing just because that's the only way you can survive. Mm. And, you know, to hell with the frills. The heck with the long-term impact of your life as a writer or all of the writers. I understand what you're saying, that sometimes your head is it's just at one grindstone and moves on to the next one, and there is no time to think about things. But ultimately, you know that we're interested in the truth and lies and subtlety and surprises, and there's a place in us, you know, for sentimentality. Cinderella Man, the boxer, and so on, and we look to think that good and truth win out in the long run, but we know better. But there's all of that aspect, you know. But not everybody's a writer. The people that are plumbers are certainly doing a good job, and heaven knows we couldn't live without them.
Yeah, yeah.
But the writers are the ones that just want something else. We want something above that. We're much more interested in the human mind than we are in the human hands and what they can and cannot do.
Well, there's also one other thing I wanted to ask you about. And you left in one of your comments on my site that the media was not being kind to you because you probably deserved it. What did you mean by this exactly?
Well, that takes me back to my short, fat, dumb, and ugly thing. TV stations and radio stations and newspapers and so on, they have consultants. Mm-hmm. They can look back at history and say, now this works. You see this fat guy here with the front of his hair sprayed white, and he's off at an angle, and he's got that kind of a Hitler beard or Laurel and Hardy thing going. This doesn't work. Besides, the American public doesn't want to hear the truth. They don't care whether or not it comes in funny or not. They got better things to do. You know, this guy poking fun at our institutions and making us question everything that we do and all of that. Just get out there and tell us whether or not taxes are going up or not, and when we're going to get that damn $600 check in the mail. You know, don't mess around with it. Don't spend any time on this. And I had a friend of mine one time. He was at an RTNDA meeting, Radio and Television News Director Association thing, and I was there with him. And he asked. There was a room full of news directors. There must have been 30 or 40 of them there. And I think this was in L.A. or San Diego. And he said, he was up at the podium, and I was just sitting out there listening with everybody else. And he said, how many news directors out here would like to have, say, Will Rogers on your news staff? He was an on-air talent. Yeah. And I mean, tell you, every hand went up. And he Okay, now how many of you would be willing to swap one of your full-time reporter positions for Will Rogers? And all the hands went right down.
Yeah.
I didn't belong there. But somehow, I did. I managed to survive all those years.
Is this why, when you moved to the Pacific Northwest, that you moved to more sort of straight reporting of issues, away from these particular commentaries when you did some of your later work?
No, all my people are from out here originally. I was born in Spokane, grew up in a little town called Moses Lake. Actually, the other half of my life, I grew up in San Francisco, but my high school years were back up here in Washington State again. The book that I wrote, Golden Toe of the Appaloosa, takes place in Moses Lake, Washington, where I spent my high school years. No, I came back here because my mom was here and my relatives, and the second and last divorce I would ever go through was over, and, why the hell you're interested in the truth, why not? I was coming home to die, and I wanted to be by myself. It wasn't anything I was, you know, going to be theatrical about or anything else. And had I done my homework, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation now. And instead, I woke up, and pale as a sheet and deaf as a stone. And for the first time in the longest time in my life, I could feel the wind on my face and the sun on my face, which I hadn't felt since I was a child. I mean, really, really felt, and I was, and Wayne Bowe was dead. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the incredible agony that I had from the loss of my children from two marriages, which was made Vietnam seem like a cakewalk. I'd go back to Nam for 10 years before I'd go through the loss of children in a divorce. I wouldn't wish that on a rock, 1980 or otherwise. And I lived through it, and I'm out of the business, so I did not come back here to write or to return to straight news or anything like it. Somebody finally discovered me out here, one of my friends in the Bay Area, and got me hooked up with the Yahoo weather thing. And I liked that because nobody knew who I was. And that lasted for a couple of years until the dot-com crash.
Yeah.
And that's the last thing I ever did for the business, and I doubt I'll ever do anything again.
Well, you're still writing in some sense. I mean, certainly there's something to be said for that. I mean, and I have to say that if you were to release these clips to something like YouTube, I suspect that, or is the Wayne Woe persona essentially dead? Do you miss it in any way, or?
I do, because he was really so naive and well-intentioned. He had an attitude that he was not a person of value, either personally or professionally, except that periodically, professionally, you know, they'd give him these awards every now and then. And when you look at a row of Emmys or a couple of ACE nominations at the national level, you're thinking, well, you know, God, maybe there was something to him. But I missed that that he didn't really understand that he was doomed. You know, from the get-go, people don't like to marry fat people. I don't care what anybody tells me. I was doomed across the board. I mean, I wasn't going to succeed, personally, and the success privately was just a shock. And of course, when it was only finally over, why, hell, I knew that was coming. That just fit right into my original concept that I was a person of no value. So, when I look back and see that he was, you know, doing comedy when there was not one stone on another, you know, left from Rome, I was amazed. I don't know how the hell kept him going, but he gave it all he had, and he did it in what I think what any sane person might call the worst of times.
Well, I think the fact that you produce such extraordinary clips, I mean, frankly, these totally outshined my memory of them. I just want to say that. I mean, and I think that this is a body of work to be seriously proud of, persona or, you know, just even from behind the scenes. That you put this quality out in the face of considerable sort of personal trauma is really to be seriously commended. And I would like to just thank you, first of all, for taking the time to talk to me, but also thank you for allowing me to go down this really unexpectedly pleasant trip down memory lane, but also a reminder to what this particular time period, you under certain constraints, you managed to actually create these commentaries that really were very much ahead of their time, I think.
Well, bless your heart. I certainly appreciate that, and it was a pleasure for me too.
Okay. Well, Wayne, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much. Are you there?
You're more than welcome.
Yeah. Hang on. Hey, are you okay?